Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again, Sentinels of the Multiverse, a cooperative superhero card game, and listeners like you. Thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, I'm Eric Scott DeVee, author and writer in Forgotten Realms, and you're listening to the Tome Show.
Welcome to the Tome, a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we're going to get our next assignment from the Court of Stars as Jeff flits around like a pixie as we review Heroes of the Feywild.
Woohoo! I'm a pixie. I'm gonna turn you all invisible.
Woohoo! Sneak attack!
That's right. All right. And joining us today is Michael, the online DM, your first-ish appearance on the Tome Show.
Yes, it is. Hi there.
I mean, it's your first appearance on the Tome Show, but not your first appearance on the feed, because you were the guest on episode 2 of the Dice Monkey Radio.
Dice Monkey Radio,
which came out recently from mm-hmm. when we're recording this. And we also have the return of Marcelo Dior, adding his foreign accent to the mix, making us sound sophisticated. Welcome back, sir.
Oh, making us sound sophisticated, right. Thanks for having me back. It's good to be back.
Good. I'm glad to have you. We're going to jump right into the news, and I think let's jump to the last bit of news first, and then we'll work our way over, because I think some people are wanting to hear about this. Here's what happened. I kind of ended up with an extra copy of the book, and so I thought it would be great to encourage people to come onto the live chat and join us while we record, and if you did so... Or do so anyway. At the end of the episode, we will come up with some way of deciding who's going to get that live or get that free copy of the book within the United States. I'm not going to pay shipping out of my pocket to go overseas, but within the United States, I will ship a copy of the book out to whoever's there at the end. So you got to hang on to the end if you want to win the book. Ha ha ha.
Sweet, you're going to do that? I've heard that if you have two copies, it creates a Fey Crossing.
Right. And here's the thing. I don't want to go to the Feywild.
You don't want to go to the Feywild?
No, see, I'm not really a fairy person, turns out. I'm not a big fan of the Feywild, generally speaking. So I don't want to go.
Well, there's scary stuff in the Feywild that could come through that crossing and eat you.
Right, and so I want to get this other one out of my house. So that's the first bit of news, and, you know, if... Anybody out there that is listening or any of our guests want to get out there and tweet it up and let people know to come and join us at mixler.com/squatch, SQUACH/live, then if they're on by the end of the episode, they are eligible to win. So that's what's going on with that. There's new stuff with the character builder. Michael, I think you use the character builder a lot. What's all the new stuff that they've added?
Well, I'll admit I don't know all of it, but you can finally upload your own portraits, which I was really excited about. I finally had one of the great cartoonists out there in D&D land, James Stowe, create a portrait for one of my characters, and I was able to put it on my character sheet now in the builder, which is really exciting. So that's cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it makes me
feel
very
James
cool
Stowe is great.
Oh yeah, he's really good. So plug for James Stowe there. He's still doing commissions too, I think. So go get your character portraits made by a real artist. So that's exciting to have that in the character builder finally. They also do have the content from Heroes of the Feywild, from what I understand. I haven't actually played with it yet, but I believe they added that as of last week's update as we're recording this. So should be exciting. I'm looking there right now. The pixies are present, so you can finally be a pixie and all the other stuff we're going to talk about from the new book. There's also a little bit more house rule support The main thing I've seen is if you want to add a bonus feat, and I know a lot of DMs like to give away the expertise feats for free. They call it a feat tax, and they don't want to make their players choose it, so they say, here, take that for free. You can do that now. You can do things like adding powers that you don't qualify for, like powers from outside your class or extra powers, things along those lines. It's not to the point yet where I don't think you can type in your own, like if you have a house-ruled feat that doesn't exist in the official compendium, you can't type it in yet, like you used to be able to under the old character builder or custom magic item. I don't think they've gotten that far yet. Have you guys played around with it at all? Do you know?
I actually ran into it on accident. I was updating a character a couple weeks ago, and I noticed that, and like, hey, that's kind of neat. I haven't seen that before, so I started hitting buttons to see what would happen. And it started house ruling my character. It's like, oh no, now I have all these new powers, and there's no way to get rid of them. You can't, once you've house ruled it, like I couldn't figure out.
Oh, really?
I couldn't figure out how to make them go away. So I just unselected all of them and didn't pick any of them. But it was there saying, hey, you should pick two more powers. I'm like, no, I don't want them.
All right, so there's still some kinks to work out.
Yeah, sure. But hey, you know, one of the big problems when they went to the web app is that it didn't have a lot of the customization features, and at this point, they're adding more and more of those, and it's getting pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think that it's a step in the right direction. I mean, some people complain that it's still, the new builder still doesn't do everything that the old downloadable one did, and I will say that the one that I'm hoping for, I can't wait until they finally do it, is give us some way to customize the layout of the character sheet, because I love having a one-page character sheet and then power cards separately from that, and you just can't do that anymore. You can't drag around the different pieces and cut what you don't want and drop what you want to the place where you want it, but I have faith that someday we will get that function again.
Yeah, see, I've gone paperless on my character sheets. I bring my iPad to the table, and that is my character sheet.
Very smart. Yeah. Do you use iPlay4E or just have a PDF? Or
When I've got a stable internet connection, I use iPlay4E, and when I don't, I use an app called i4E. I actually did a review of a whole bunch of apps and things for iOS on on my website, temporaryhitpoints.com.
Very good.
So I sort of discuss a lot of that there.
I use a different app. I'm trying to find it here. I'm not actively using it anymore, because I tried to go sheetless on one recent adventure that one of my players wanted to be a DM. So I figured in it as a player, and I tried to go digital with my character. The name is Drums of War.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty good app, but I missed fiddling with the power cards, and I tried to make my players use their laptops and gadgets instead of paper to have less paper on the table. We play in a small table, but I'm still the only one who brings the laptop over. I think a lot of DMs out there would like a group like mine that don't bring cell phones or laptops or gadgets, and I would like them to.
Yeah, Drums of War is one of the ones I actually looked at as a player option. And just a heads up, I think there are better options out there for you. So look around.
No, but I quit using it. The only reason I still have it here is because I forgot to delete it. The app, the D&D app I use and love, is Compendium. Simply called Compendium. It accesses the compendium.
the guy who wrote that is the same guy who does i4e, the character sheet app.
Oh wow, good to know.
Yep. All right. Well, we've sort of diverged a little bit, but it's good conversation. And it let me, you know, pimp one of my websites, so that's cool. temporaryhitpoints.com. The other update that I think I'm more excited about is the Monster Builder update that's happened in the recent month or two or however long it. I've been taking a hiatus from DMing, so I didn't even notice it for a while. But this is the big update to me, because the old web app Monster Builder did not actually build monsters, which is a problem for a monster builder.
Yeah.
Whereas the new one, I think I can build monsters. And that
you can indeed.
And that's awesome, because that means I can now uninstall Windows from my laptop. I don't need it anymore. The only thing I was using it for on my MacBook, the only thing I was using Windows for was the Monster Builder.
Wow. That makes two of us.
Yeah.
It's the only single reason I still have Windows installed in my Mac, is because of the darn app.
Yep, but now you don't need it. You can do it on the web app.
Yep, one of my players, for some reason, I quit using the I stopped using the monster builder for monster customization. I was customizing monsters on the fly, if sometimes half an hour before play. Mm-hmm. I was using a lot of monsters from the books, like as is. So I was bringing the books to the table, and for a while I was not using the monster builder, even to print out the monsters. I just went to the compendium and printed out the print screen of the monster mm-hmm. sheet. So one of my players came to me, I think three weeks ago, and told me the monster builder had updated itself, and it was, I don't think it has all the functionalities of the old install, does it?
Probably not. And actually, there's new sort of kinks, I think, to keep an eye on. Maybe Tracy knows more about this than I do, because Tracy lives in the world of technology and coding. But I thought I heard recently that Microsoft has decided that they're going to stop supporting Silverlight, which all the web apps are built on.
Mm-hmm.
Which might mean that they have to go back to the drawing board on all the web apps.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember seeing something about that flash past my screen, but I've been kind of heads down lately. But I did hear about that. And I know Adobe is also getting rid of mobile flash support, so a lot of things are going towards HTML5 now.
But I hope that Wizards has a plan for what to do if Silverlight goes away and Flash is not an option and they have to start all over again with this product. You know, they're just now getting the web apps to the point that I think people can be really happy with them. You know, you still can't completely customize and add in all that third-party support and stuff that people might like to see, but you're getting real close. And now to have to start over and go back to where we were 2-3 years ago, it makes you start saying, let's just, you know, wait till 5th edition comes out in a couple months.
Right.
and Digital Draco also says one of the exciting in the chat room says one of the exciting things about the new monster builder is that you can now export your monsters, which is actually really cool too. Because I don't actually.
Yeah, that's one I wanted to talk about because I love exporting it. Well, no, I just it does it.
Right,
I love it.
I don't typically, and it's not like I'm sitting in front of the laptop with the monster builder open when I'm running things, right? So being able to export and put things into, you know, my Word document or whatever that I'm using for my game prep is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Digital Draco specifically likes it because he's a user of Masterplan, and I think Masterplan likes to try to import a lot of data if it can. So at least this is all the stuff I'm getting from the conversation in the chat room that's happening.
Yeah, so thanks for the reminder. I'd forgotten to look at the chat. I saw there was a question about can you upload pictures into the character builder directly from your computer, and I believe so. I think when I uploaded mine, I think it was from my computer, but it was a picture I already had on my blog, so I'm honestly not positive. But yeah, I think that the monster builder being all set up and being able to export is great, although I will also mention there is a program called PowerTool, that's P-O-W-E-R, number 2-O-O-L, that some of you might have tried out. I like it for building monsters too. It has mm-hmm. nice export functions, and whenever I'm putting adventures together to put on my blog, I tend to use PowerTool, and I've been pretty happy with it.
Right on.
Cool.
Tracy, you've got exciting news that we kind of talked about on our what I'm calling the raw nude episode we did the other day without any script, and I'm pretty sure half of us were drunk. So let's give it an honest, real sort of look at. And what's your big news? What's going on in the world of Tracy?
So the big news on my angle is that I got a column on the Wizards of the Coast website. I get to highlight the awesome community, D&D community and everything. And I should be writing about every 2 weeks, like every other week, I should have a column out. And so that's pretty awesome and scary and fun.
Right on. I know I'm excited to read it.
Oh, yeah. Me too. That's really exciting. Congratulations, Tracy.
We're going to have to start calling you a professional game designer soon.
Woo-hoo. Start.
Yeah, you heard me. As a general rule, I pretty much say you either have to be making your living from game design, or you have to have your name on the cover of a physical book.
Okay, so it's a cover.
If you get a cover, then yeah, you're totally professional, and we have to start looking for your replacement.
Okay.
So you just self-publish something and put your name on the cover, and bam, you're a professional in Jeff's book then.
I know. I was pretty sure Sickness in Springdale, I mean, they didn't have a name on a cover, but
I said
it would have been there.
Physical book. Physical book.
Yeah, it's available in print.
Is it? Oh, I thought it was just PDF.
No, it's self-print. Well, that's the same thing, right?
It's physical. See, we're being literal on this episode.
Oh, yeah, we are being literal on this episode. Well, anyway, I suppose it's time to move along. So for those of you, let's see, how many of you are there now? Ten people chatting away in the chat room as you listen along. Hang on to the end of the episode, and you will be eligible to win Heroes of the Feywild, and I will try to come up with some way to decide who's going to win it by the time we get to the end. So you guys have to run this thing while I let my brain chew on that.
Whatever we decide to give it away, you got to use dice in some manner.
Oh, then I have to go get dice. Ooh, I've got a D20 in front of me. My son was playing with the Castle Ravenloft board game, so I can use that.
Good enough.
Good. Okay, so today we're going to talk about Heroes of the Feywild, in case you hadn't caught on to that. But before we get into that, let's look at our first sponsor.
Our first sponsor is Sentinels of the Multiverse by Greater Than Games. It's a non-collectible cooperative card game about superheroes. You get to go up against villains, create teams, lots of fun. Yeah.
Sounds awesome. Sentinels of the Multiverse is not a collectible card game, and it's also a cooperative game. So it's one of those things that, you know, even though it says it's not meant for kids my son's age, who's 5, I can actually play with him, just like I play Castle Ravenloft or Wrath of Ashardalon or whatever with him, because it's cooperative. So I can, you know, I can help him with the math or figure out what the powers do or whatever. So I'm a fan of cooperative games, especially when doing things with my children. So
sweet.
And superheroes. I mean, how are superheroes not awesome?
Exactly.
Greater Than Games is all about making the games that we've always wanted to play. We love playing games, and we love our ridiculous process of game creation. The most important thing to us is to make the sorts of games we want to play available to everyone. Go to sentinelsofthemultiverse.com for more information.
So let's look at Heroes of the Feywild. We have a total of, 5 chapters? And the first one is all about... The first one is basically your big chapter of fluff.
Yeah, although I will say one thing I like about this book is you get fluff throughout. But yeah, chapter one is all the fluff. Here's what the Feywild is, and here's what your life is like if you're from there, and all kinds of good stuff.
By halfway through chapter one, I was sold. Man, when I bought this book, I paid it, and I started thinking, oh my God, what have I done? I bought a fey book, a book about unicorns and puppies and rainbows. Halfway through, I kept thinking, why did I bought, of all the books I could have bought, I don't buy a D&D book, although I play twice a week, I don't buy a D&D book for almost 2 years now. And I decided, of all the books, I decided to buy a fey book. But my players would never want to play anything like it. But halfway through the first chapter, I was sold. Man, that... I was drooling on the book, like wow, awesome text, awesome fluff.
Yeah, and I have to say, one of the things that I feel like Wizards has done a really good job of in the last, even 6 months or so, is I feel like they've really stepped it up in terms of quality of books. Now, in this case, I'm not a big fan of the Feywild. Which seems strange because somehow I've accidentally taken my campaign there like twice. I don't know, but it keeps happening. It's completely out of my control, I guess. But I'm not a fan of the Feywild, and yet there's a lot in this book I really liked. That said, I think my least favorite part is this opening chapter. It's 19 pages, 15 pages of here's what's in the Feywild. It's sort of your setting section. And I was kind of about that section. You know, not that the writing was bad or what have you, just that I'm not that interested, I guess, in the Feywild in this way, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I'll say actually, I agree with you. I mean, it's well written, and if you want to play a game in the Feywild, there's tons of inspiration here. You know, the different Fey courts, some of the different cities from the Eladrin and the Archfey, and the Mercandraw, you know, the swamp that they have. Those are interesting places, and they're well described here. But I agree with you. I mean, it didn't excite me that much reading it. I read it because I figured I had to read the whole book, but I was happy to get past this and into the stuff with races and classes and stuff for your character.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I didn't feel like I was missing setting stuff as a result of all this. Having spent a lot more time in sort of the crunch areas, I thought, you know, maybe I was going to be missing out on some of the setting and the story and all that. And I wasn't, because one of the things they did a really good job of is incorporating a lot of the fluff and a lot of the flavor into the rest of the book as well. And even into some of the mechanics. And I guess we'll get into that later on. But there are some places where mechanics actually support story in a way that I think a lot of people wanted to see more of earlier in the edition, that is they've been doing really well at, I think, in the last several books here.
Well, maybe it's because it's been a couple of years since I bought and read Wizards WotC book, but two things that stands aside on the first chapter to me that really caught my attention. First, the layout. The layout, I don't know if they're doing this in more recent books, but the layout is so very different. Those little petals and flowers and masks and little illustrations throughout the pages, centered on the pages, and a lot of side notes, a lot of side boxes with bard's tales. Again, something that's throughout the book, that's all around the book, but the design of the book, I really liked it, and the illustrations, the pictures, they're gorgeous, and the little tiny little stories that come as like captions in a lot of the big pictures, they tell a little story of five, maybe six characters throughout the book. We mm-hmm. are presented on page here 7. Two characters, Skelder and Rowena. Later on in the book, we realize they are a barbarian and a witch. And by the end of the book, Rowena has to kill Skelder. So I really wanted to hear that story, to read that story. So a little story told through the pictures. I really loved it.
Yeah, and there is a lot of consistency of the pictures. I mean, you have sort of like they used to do back in the third edition days, right, where you had sort of the iconic characters, and they appear at that time not only just throughout a book but throughout multiple books oftentimes. They seem to be building some of that here as well, where it's like, here are the characters of this book. Let's use them in as many illustrations as possible throughout. And I thought that was really cool. And you're right, it does kind of tell a little bit of a story. You feel like these are actual, you know, characters in a story, and there's a book there that could be written.
And I think something cool about that is that they actually never introduce these characters in the text that I could find. It's solely in the captions. And so it's sort of a little bonus for the people who look at the artwork. You know, you can see these characters showing up several times, and you can kind of figure out the story. It's not quite like following a comic book exactly, but different scenes that show up with these same characters and going their separate ways. But they never actually tell you, here's the story of these characters. They don't just spell it right out, which I sort of like. I think that's sort of fun.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I wonder, I guess it'd be interesting to get one of the designers on at some point, but I wonder if it wasn't just the artist that sort of said, hey, you've asked me to do a bunch of these illustrations, I'm just going to do it all this way and keep using these same characters, and then it worked out really well. I don't know.
Something else that I really like. Go ahead, Trace, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I thought I heard Greg say on Twitter that he and the other people, Rodney, worked hard on getting the art right for this, but I can't recall exactly what he said.
Well, I think they did a good job.
Yeah, it does look like there's at least a couple different artists. I see Mark Winters. I see Tyler. What was the name again? There's a few different artists that are drawing these same characters, so, which is kind of cool.
Well, and there are some art pieces that don't fit the, you know, like I'm looking at the beginning of chapter 2, and there's sort of that set piece piece of art that's the full page that doesn't have those characters in it. You know, so every now, you know. You could have a few artists that are contributing some of these other things that aren't, you know, the ones with all those characters could be from the same artist. I don't know.
Yeah, I see at least a couple in the first chapter, some from Mark Winter, some from Tyler Jacobson. So okay. At least those two contributed with those same iconic characters, yeah.
Very cool.
Something else that I really like.
And Ryan Barger later on, too. So, yeah.
This is pretty much, chapter one is pretty much the only chapter with DM stuff, in my opinion. Oh, we have a lot of stuff and story and setting throughout the book, but the idea, I loved it because I'm mostly, I'm 99.9% of the time a DM. I almost never play. So a lot of the character things, I was thinking of them something to present my players. Like, wouldn't you like to play as a pixie, maybe? Or this new druid that's so like AD&D. But the first chapter, a lot of stuff for me as the DM. And especially the part where they start by telling how a person of the world, how a mortal would see the Feywild, and then bringing up the how would you, being born in the Feywild on those regions, how what you know it's true, and even some legends, those true sides. I really liked it.
Right on. Now, in the past, if they were to follow the same sort of formula, I think what we would see, you know, like what they did with Shadow, right? There was a DM product. And then there were Heroes of Shadow. Heroes of Shadow was intended to be for the players. And then, what was it, Shadowfell, Gloomrot, and Beyond was sort of your DM Shadowfell product. It was a box set, not a book specifically. So, you know, they could have gone that route. So they did squeeze a little bit of setting in there for you as a DM. But largely, there's not a lot of DM stuff here. You're right. I mean, it's primarily a player book, and I think that was intentional, but it's a player book with a lot of setting and story and things in it that do give inspiration to a DM.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that to see some something I could use, like I run a Planescape for 3 years now, almost four. I think it's more 3 than 4 years. A Planescape 4E campaign, and I really wanted something to replace the Feywild, the Beastlands, and some other places on Planescape that the Elven gods and the Greek gods and the beasts, the wild beasts, come from. I was kind of hoping to use that, and not enough for me in this book, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's, you were looking for something very specific. And then, you know, it's hard for them to tailor to your specific needs, right?
So I can sort of understand.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're a loyal customer who buys a book every 2 years, so they absolutely should. So let's jump into chapter two, because it sounds like we're eager to move along, and people are eager to hear some of the crunch. At least I'm eager to talk about it, because that's where I feel like the book really did well.
The problem, Jeff, when you bring me on an episode once every year, you get your biggest, largest episode, or the one you have to cut out a lot of things. I talk too much.
No, you're doing great, because when you talk, we get that air of sophistication with the accent, right?
Yeah, that's right. Another way to saying that my English is really bad.
Or people are just screaming at you because you mispronounce a lot of things. One of those two. I haven't decided, but either way, I'm entertained. which is really what this is all about, right? I mean,
apparently,
the whole point of the podcast is to entertain Jeff.
Yes.
Right.
We aim to serve.
Excellent. So in chapter two, we get new races. And there are three. All of which, I guess, are kind of throwbacks to races we've had access to in previous editions. As long as you don't mind changing the name of Dryad into Hamadryad. But we get the Hamadryad, which is kind of the Dryad light. We get the Pixie, and we get the Satyr, or Satyr. Or however, I'm not Greek and...
I will say Satyr, and I have no idea if it's right or not, and that's okay.
Well, let's ask Marcelo. He's the expert on how to pronounce things.
Well, I was thinking about asking you guys if it was Satire or Satyr.
What do you say, Tracy? You're the
Satyr.
You're the educated one here, right?
Well, I have a Greek here.
Saturn?
What?
You have a Greek what?
I have a Greek book here somewhere. I'm just besides my bookshelf. Let's see if I can find it here. It was one of my favorite subjects on my sophomore year at college. Let me see. Here it is. Well, keep talking. I'll see if I can find the Greek pronunciation.
Matt Getz is in the audience now, joining us as well, and he says it's pronounced Seder.
Well,
and
Seder.
And Digital Draco insists that hamadryads are legitimate mythological creatures, and I didn't mean to imply that they weren't. Just that in D&D terms, they feel like dryad light.
Now we get the well actually live.
I know. Maybe we don't like this whole live thing. People keep correcting us.
Listen, as long as they're correcting you, it's fine.
Well, maybe if somebody else, one of the other co-hosts, would talk every now and then, they could be corrected.
No, that's okay.
So let's talk about these races. Hamadryad. Somebody tell me what it is and why it's awesome.
Okay. It's a tree lady, basically. So it's a half sort of half nymph, half tree spirit. And I would say my take on the Hamadryad is I think the mechanics are actually pretty cool. You know, she has an interesting she's always female. There's no male Hamadryads. And the racial utility power is sort of cool in that you can either get combat advantage against every enemy you can see, or you can get resistance to all damage, you know, 5, 10, 15, depending on your tier, for a turn. And those are both, you know, pretty solid powers, I think. You know, you compare it to the Goliath's stone skin or whatever it's called, where the Goliath can get some damage resistance. The Hamadryad can sort of do that with an option to instead get combat advantage. And she also has an ability to make saving throws or a bonus to saving throws against stun, dominate, and daze, which that's what you really want to save against, right? So I think mechanically, that's pretty good. But I will say flavor-wise, the whole you can sort of turn yourself into a tree, I don't know, it just doesn't grab me like some of the other races do.
Well, and the Dryad and the Hamadryad are also, they're sort of tough ones, right? Because part of, I guess, the whole point of the Dryad is that they're bonded to a forest and a tree, and they're going to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to do that and be an adventurer. Now, they do give some little bits and explaining sort of how you could play this and be an adventurer and be the exception rather than the rule. It is hard to be a wandering adventurer when you're supposed to be tied to a specific tree and protect it.
Yeah, they give a couple of excuses of why you would be adventuring. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find the exact text here, but there's something to do with the loss of your tree,
mm-hmm.
or a curse or a promise, but those things are like they are transitory. They are momentary. Eventually, it seems that the Hamadryad should get back to her tree or find a new tree or become a tree herself. I'm thinking of the Hamadryad as an opportunity, one of those adventure parties that are stationary. They have one base of operations. So maybe her tree is in got transplanted to the middle of the town, something like that. But I agree, it's a very difficult race to sell to players.
Yeah.
Well, and I think they try to be careful in this book to at least give you some hooks for a Hamadryad who travels with the party and gets far away from her tree. I mean, the tree could be destroyed if she survived it, or there could be some meaningful quest to save nature in general that she gets caught up in, even if it takes her far from her tree home. So, and I appreciate that.
Especially when you mix her up with the druid build later in the book, it's a good idea.
And there's one line that sells it for me. It says, you're accustomed to being in charge. And, you know.
Tracy can get behind that, huh?
I can get behind that. That's approved.
Right.
And one hey, it's girl power, too. They're always female.
Now, that said, one of the things I really like about the way they're doing races in these books and recent books is they're giving you a lot of fluff and information and inspiration and ideas, tips on role-playing, tips on how to build characters and what races to use. And I really like the idea of adding in the utility powers, because this is where they start to support the story with the mechanics in ways that, that I feel like would have been awesome to see earlier in the game.
And it's something they promised back in 2007. Mm-hmm. They promised that.
And in fairness, back in 2007, I mean, it they're on like what a year or two long cycle. So, what they're working on in 2007 is only a couple years old at this point.
Yeah.
The one nitpick I have about the Hama Dryad is that dryads and their other adult or their other parental unit, right, the nymph, are all about sort of this beauty is this big thing that's part of them, and they give you mechanics to support that, but I almost feel like when I look at looking at ability scores, the options should have been +2 charisma. And then +2 wisdom or intelligence. I think the charisma should be a given, and then the other two are the options. But that's a pretty small nitpick, because I can still build the character I want to build when I look at that character, or when I look.
Well, I'm okay with the wisdom being first, because you know nature is a wisdom skill, and Hamadryads are sort of spirits of nature. So, given that, I'm okay with wisdom being the one you're locked into.
Yeah.
But you are right that you could theoretically make an uncharismatic dryad, which is a little strange.
Right. But that's fine.
Yeah.
Should we move
on to
Pixie?
But then why would the goblins drool over her?
It kind of reminded me, this book is very Tolkien-esque. It's very Lord of the Ringy. And some of the art and some of the text reminded me of like the Silmarillion. Especially the art from page 24, it looks like when what's the name of the Luthien? She's enthralling Melkor's like the palace, while Beren creeps up and steals one of the Silmarils. It reminded me of that. Like, no, it doesn't matter if you're a goblin or an ugly creature of the bog. Beauty is universal. That's so cute.
And I kind of like that. You know, now that you mentioned that Patreon 24, where the Hamadryad is glowing with beauty and enthralling the goblins, it looks like, from a mechanical perspective, she's probably using the utility power, the level 16 utility of Faeborn Majesty, and enthralling all of them. So that's kind of cool.
All right, so I think the chat room really wants us to talk about pixies, and we are at like 40 minutes and only on page 28.
Pixies!
So let's hit pixies and move along to other things, because I don't want the episode to go 7 hours long.
Have you noticed that although they pretty much describe the pixies as the fey counterpart of human children, they don't really describe the form, the physical form of the pixie. And throughout the book, you have dozens of pixie illustrations, and some are more human, some are more insect-like, some have weird faces, some have elven faces, some have like insect feet, and some are very elfish. They give you a lot of opportunity to choose how your pixies would look like. Just saying.
And I don't disagree. I was distracted by discussions in the chat room, but Matt also agrees with you. The big question that a lot of people I think are having, and a lot of our chat room is having, is what's the deal with? Okay, great, they've got a fly speed, but why the altitude limit of one?
Let's not debate magical physics or magical logic.
Well, and it's only like at the end of the turn, right? You can go more than one during the flight, right? As long as you end one square above. So
right.
Yeah.
So I think that the answer is probably game balance, not flavor. You know, I think that if you had no limit on your height, then a pixie could fly above. You could be a pixie ranger or something and fly, you know, 20 feet above the battlefield the whole time, and melee monsters could never get to you. That would be probably a little unbalanced. But the ultimate limit of one means...
Maybe the air is too thin after 1 foot for the pixie to breathe.
Yes, because all of 5 feet, that's... the air gets really thin 5 feet up.
I'm going to say that every pixie is cursed with crippling acrophobia, fear of heights, so they can't get too high or else they get nauseated.
They're having lots of
the
fun
air
in the
gets
chat
too
room.
Thin, and they start laughing all the time.
Yeah,
it's like when you go to the dentist, they give you the nitrous oxide. It's like that. They're useless in battle once they start giggling.
So the answer is game balance, and we just have to suck it up and even though it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It sounds like it's an excellent house rule if that's what you want.
Well, and it feels like there ought to be a way to change that altitude limit, right? I don't know if I missed it on the feats or utility power or something, but it seems like there should be something that allows you to increase that altitude limit.
It's one of those.
I don't remember seeing anything like that.
And Cato is suggesting that the Formorians lash a bunch of pixies to a skiff to make a Fey hovercraft.
Delightfully evil. I like it.
I do too.
But I don't want people to think that I want to enslave all the pixies, because I wasn't really sure what to think when I first heard about the pixie announcement. But I gotta say, as a race, I like it. I think it'll be an interesting race to see in play. I have one of my players from my Friday night game is rolling up a new character, and she is, in fact, making a pixie. So we'll get to see a pixie in action this week, and I'm excited about that. I made a pixie berserker to share on my blog, because I thought that would just be hilarious to have a pixie that charges into bad guy spaces and then locks them down with the defender aura that the berserker gets. So much potential for mayhem with pixies. Although I will say, I don't think a party that's all pixies, I guess it's all pixies, sure, that's fine. But if you have a human, an elf, and three pixies walking along together, it's going to be a strange party in social situations.
I just want to hide everywhere. A little tiny pixie gets to hide everywhere.
Well, and you know what I like about the pixie is there's a lot of the utility powers and things that are more about party support. You know, it's bringing in elements of the pixie that have existed in stories and what have you that haven't always existed in D&D. Like the idea of sprinkling your fairy dust on the rest of the party, and now they can all fly for a little bit.
Yeah,
I liked how they were very clever with the mechanics of having a tiny creature as a PC, like the way they shrink their anything they want to carry, the fact that it doesn't matter if they're tiny, they are considered small for weapon and damage and attack purpose. I liked it. I liked the way they kept it simple.
They did. I think in previous editions they solved that problem by giving more or less like sort of magical sort of powers rather than just keeping the damage sort of reasonable. They said, well, you're not going to do very much damage, but you can make these sleep arrows and things like that. So I think this is a little bit less fiddly design choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. They did a nice job with the design. I think it'll work pretty well.
All right, let's go on to the Satyr, which I'm going to pronounce it Satyr because Matt Getz says I should.
I found it. The UK pronunciation is Satyr, and the US pronunciation is Satyr. And if you want the Greek pronunciation, it's Saturos.
Let's go with the U.S. then.
Okay. I'm going to go with Satyr because Matt tells me to.
Okay.
That sounds good.
Okay, so well, if Satyr, what do we like?
Hamadryads only have females, only have ladies, and the Satyr only have dudes. Only dude Satyrs, thank God.
What?
Yeah. Well, sorry, it's a sexist world out there.
I was
really, Tracy? Now you're mad? It's okay when it's only female, but when it's only male, screw them.
Yeah.
Well, I don't like that the female only gets like, oh my god, I'm pretty, and the satyr gets, I get to get with anybody I want. Yeah, that's a real win.
They're not saying that it's only the dudes in this book who get it on with everybody, because if you read the Pixie creation story, they talk about the Summer Queen having four different guys who might have been the Pixie's real father, and they all think that they're the guy. So what does that tell you? The girls in the Feywild, they get around too.
And for what it's worth, Tracy, it looks like Matt Getz is on your side. He's upset that there is no Satris.
Satris, I love it.
Hey, apparently, it's a thing. He's linking us to a Wikipedia article.
Yeah, so Matt is likes furries, like Dragonborn with breasts and Satyrs with breasts.
Is it good for us to insult our listeners?
Well, it's not. It's certainly not good for me, especially if I'm offending Matt.
Oh, Kato just went blue. Okay.
One of the things I really liked about this, the fact that only female Hamadryads and only male satyrs, is that it keeps in with the mythology. A lot of Greek mythology, a lot of island Irish mythology here. And, you know, myths, they don't have, they have an internal logic that only works for them. And I liked how they didn't try to modernize the myths, like trying to use magical biology and magical physics. I like the idea that, well, they are magical. They lay down with nymphs, and there comes a satyr or a nymph. I liked it. I liked how it mystical.
Well, I'll opine on the mechanic side of the satyr then. I think that the class feature that lets him gain an extra D8 for each healing surge he spends during a short rest is kind of cool. I don't totally get the flavor. I mean, pleasant recovery, they call it, but hey, it's a nice little bonus.
Satyrs are always sort of depicted in sort of these idyllic sort of settings, and so I think they're trying to sort of capture a little bit of that, right?
Yeah, maybe it's that they relax very well and can put the fury of battle behind them, and yeah, I can buy that.
I liked the utility level 2, the Satyr's Leap.
That's the one. That is the one that excites me too. I'm right there with you, Marcelo.
And it's an at will, which makes it all the better.
Exactly. Yep. For the rest, if you play a satyr, you have to take that as your level 2 utility power, because then for the rest of your entire adventuring career, you never walk anywhere. You jump, and that's just cool, you know. And from a mechanics perspective, it does kind of mean, you know, difficult terrain probably doesn't bother you. You jump right over it, right? So I think Satyr's Leap is, in my mind. That's the class feature for satyrs. They jump everywhere, and that's just awesome.
And Matt says they drink hard, they eat hard, and they healing surge hard.
That's right. Party like a satyr.
So, excellent. Now, I did find it interesting that in the middle at the end of the text for the satyr, they actually have an illustration of what do they call it? The Dark Satyr or Night Satyr?
Satyr
of Night, which really reminds me a lot of what was that movie a few years back that was in a foreign language?
Pan's
Labyrinth?
Yeah, Pan's Labyrinth. Yeah. It reminds me, the illustration reminds me a lot of Pan's Labyrinth.
It just kind of looks like that, yeah.
Although I feel like there needs to be a DDI article or something telling me as a DM, what are these Night Satyrs? I want more information and stories about them.
Well, you know, yet again, that, more stuff for that, future developers.
That picture fooled me. I didn't flip through the book before reading. I got it. I had only three or four days to read it through, and I started reading page after page without even looking what would be the next chapter. So I was kind of hoping to have a list of monsters, like another chapter for the DM, at least one chapter for the DM with monsters. Like monsters from the Feywild. And I didn't pay much attention to the Satyr of the Night. I didn't pay much attention because I thought, well, I'm going to see its stats by the end of the book, and no stats.
No luck. Well, hey, one thing, this is going back to what you said earlier, Marcelo, I like about the illustration on page 39 with the Satyr of Night is that if you look at page 121, here on page 39, they're trying to, it's Rowena and Vilfam trying to steal the ever-blooming rose from that satyr. And then on page 121, they show up in town and they've got it, and all the Eladrin are excited. It's kind of a nice little connection.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on. Chapter 3. Not to drive things forward, but I'm going to drive things forward.
Do it.
Chapter 3, classes. There aren't any new ones, so it seems like a silly chapter. Let's move on, right?
Oh.
let me just say one thing. One thing I wanted to say. It's been a couple of years since I bought D&D books. Something, maybe the only criticism I give to D&D is the fact that there are way too many classes. Something that I love about Star Wars Saga Edition. There is 5 classes. And you grab, what's the name of them? Like paths. I can't remember right now. It's just, you talent trees. You using talent trees, you customize one of the 5 classes so much that you end up having the class you want to have. And D&D has way too many classes, and every book brings forth 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 new classes, and I can keep up. The rate I kill off my PCs at the table, my players are always coming up with new characters, using new races and new classes. The races are okay, but every time I have to, a person comes out with a new class, and I say, "What is this? Where does it come from?" "Oh, it comes from this new book and from this new dragon article," and I don't know the class. I think there is a class pollution in D&D. So I like the idea that they are not really bringing new classes in Heroes of Feywild. Mm-hmm. They're bringing new builds to old classes, and I kind of liked it. The builds, the things they. It seems to me they brought some old ideas, some AD&D ideas, to a 4E kind of way.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that they've been doing a lot of that in the last several months. And in the last several Heroes books or player books have focused on, I mean, basically since Essentials come out, it's all the new classes stuff has been new builds and not new classes. I feel, and I sort of, now that they've got, I mean, they've got all the power sources covered. So you don't need new classes. Maybe you didn't need them to begin with, but they mentioned all these new power sources in the first DMG, so they sort of felt like they should flesh them out. But now that they're all there, there's no need for more classes. Just let us know how to customize the classes that exist even more, which is what they're doing with all these new builds.
Yeah, that's very good, I think.
Well, let's talk about them.
And you know what I noticed as I go through these classes? There was a time that I could very easily go through a class, and just by looking just a glance at it, I could tell you, oh, this is an Essentials class, or this is for non-Essentials characters, or whatever. And that's getting harder to do. I have to look a little bit harder. I think they're starting to blur some of those lines a little bit, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. I know that when Heroes of Shadow came out, some people were saying, "Oh, is it an Essentials book? Because I don't allow Essentials in my game, so should I ban it?" And I personally find that all silly. But yeah, I think in this book they've blurred the line. Like you said, there are some classes, like the Scald, uses a lot of basic attacks, but technically follows the at will encounter daily structure. So it is kind of in between the two.
Mm-hmm. So what do we want to say about the new classes? We've got the Berserker for the Barbarian, which kind of seems strange because Berserker and Barbarian in many ways feel like they're the same thing.
It's like saying Samurai Warrior or Ninja Assassin, but is it my impression that the Berserker is like a defender?
Yes, the Berserker is the first class that switches roles during combat, which I think is extremely cool. You start off as a defender, you have the defender aura going, you're smacking enemies that shift near you or attack your friends, and then as soon as you use a primal power, doesn't have to be a rage, like a daily power, doesn't even have to be an encounter power, you could take an at-will from one of the earlier books, a traditional barbarian at-will. As soon as you use a primal power, your aura goes away, and now you're raging, basically, effectively raging. You're now in the Berserk Fury, and you're a striker, and all your basic attacks deal extra damage, and your Berserker at-wills deal extra damage as well. Although, if you take the original Barbarian at-wills, you don't really get the bonus damage the Barbarian would.
Which is really cool. It does make min-maxers, I think, a little less happy, right? Because it's hard to min-max when you're doing two things. When you have to build a character able to do two things, which I don't think is a bad thing, you know.
I agree.
Because I'm a much bigger fan of cool mechanics and story than I am min-maxing. Now,
and I think that, you know, the Berserker can apply to a player who might like to min-max, except you're not going to min-max damage like you would with a pure striker, or min-max, I don't know, defenses or punishment right. like you would with a pure defender. But a good player will probably like the tactics. Like, hey, I can be a defender when I need to be and a striker when I need to be. That's kind of cool.
And it does make it maybe a little bit more complex of a character to run, too. And that's something that that tends to happen as an addition goes along, right? Some of the classes get more advanced.
I wouldn't hand this to a new player.
The next class or next build is for the Bard, the Scald, and it's getting lots and lots of love in the chat room. Somebody tell me why the Scald is awesome. Other than the flavor of bringing back sort of the old Celtic concept of a Bard. But Tracy, tell me about the Scald.
Well, I don't know, not necessarily about the Scald, but the Signs of Influence optional class feature is, I like that sort of thing. They have things like attract attendance, demand an audience, travel in style. I mean, how could you not like that?
Well, man, I love that. It's like fluff mechanized.
Absolutely. Right. I absolutely adore that stuff. That is the kind of thing that I find poignant throughout this book, is that there are mechanics that encourage and support role-playing and story in a way that I think some people wanted the edition to do earlier. Like fourth edition never stopped you from doing any of those things, but some of these mechanics feel like they're encouraging you to do some of these things, and that's awesome.
And this
the best part about. Go ahead, Tracy.
I was going to say this: the attract attendance kind of reminds me of old school D&D, where you could convince people, like if you're a cleric or something, to help you. So that's all I was going to say.
I like attract attendance because, frankly, you're a bard here. They're not attendants. They're groupies. You get to travel with groupies now. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
the bard that I like to play, Factotum, he's going to have groupies as soon as he can become a Scald. No doubt about it.
Factotum? Really? Nice.
Yes. Factotum is the name of my bard for LFR games.
I'm trying to find a sidebar here. It's not on the bard. Maybe it's certainly on another page. There's one of those bard's tale. Tales that are sprinkled throughout the book. One of them, it seems that it gives I don't know how to say that in English. It pinches. I don't know how to say that. Like, you know, those people that say that, oh, how could a bard how can a gelatinous cube get pruned or get enchanted? Blah 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 blah. There's one of those bard's tale here about an old bard. Page 58, the Scald's apprentice, where the Scald he enchants some bears, and the apprentice is amazed that, well, how could the bears hear your story about a cub that got stung and etc. And he says, they don't need to understand me; they just need to hear my voice. So it's kind of they are kind of, I don't know how to say this in English, they are pointing out to those haters that say, how could a gelatinous cube be prone? And say, that's how.
Yeah, they're sort of tweaking them, or you can sometimes say they're hanging a lampshade on it. So I'll take just a moment to talk about the Scald mechanic stuff, because I do like the Scald mechanic. I think that the fact that the Scald has an aura around him, and in that aura, any of his allies can use a minor action to spend a healing surge and get some bonus hit points. I think that's pretty cool. It doesn't have to be the Scald doing it. Anybody can do it. And mm-hmm. they can do it for themselves, or they can do it for somebody next to them. If somebody is dying, anybody can sort of be the healer by mm-hmm. taking advantage of the Scald's aura. I think that's extremely cool.
Yep.
And I also love the ability that the Scald has to use charisma for his basic attacks, because it is sort of a basic attack focused class, and of course, you know, most bards are going to have high charisma, not much strength.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Let's keep moving along, so we're good on time. Next is the Druid. We have a new Druid build, the Protector, which it makes sense to have a Druid build in a Feywild book. The Protector is... It feels to me like the Protector build is a lot of trying to continue to pull in concepts from older editions for the Druid, right?
Pretty much.
One of the things you could do in 3rd edition with a Druid is... just constantly summon new creatures to create sort of this little army of things that are fighting in your stead. And this Druid build sort of seems to do a lot of that, right?
And the fact that you have a Druid circle, like it's a Druid organization that used to have back on AD&D and 3rd edition.
Well, a couple cool things I liked about this druid. I mean, first of all, the flavor felt, you have to admit, kind of like Pokemon here, you know, summoning monsters to fight for you. But that's okay. Pets are cool. But I liked some of the flavor slash mechanic stuff. Like, they have these primal attunement things that are sort of cantrips, you know, druid cantrips, the senses of the wild and call the spirits that are kind of similar to the stuff the wizard can do with something like a prestidigitation. And the vine rope, where you can sort of make a rope out of a vine, you know, 50 feet long, you have silk rope now. That's just kind of neat stuff that's mostly flavor, but can have nice little mechanical benefits too.
Mm-hmm. I liked the combo with Nature's Growth. That is a daily utility, encounter utility, where you create pretty much a zone of difficult terrain, and a couple of pages later, you have one, I'm trying to find it here, another power that the difficult terrain is not difficult for you, but it's difficult for your allies. There is a power somewhere here where it becomes normal terrain for your allies and only difficult terrain for your... I cannot find it. For your only your enemies see it as...
It's one of the circles, right? Yeah, it's the circle of shelter. Yeah, if you take that option, mm-hmm. your allies can ignore the difficult terrain.
I thought it... the thing that I like the most about the mechanic side of this new druid.
Okay.
Something maybe because it's something that my players would use a lot. They love doing those things that hindering terrain and things that give them a movement advantage against my monsters. So that's something. That's why it stood out to me.
Right on. Good information, good deals. We are on page 80 and an hour and 5 minutes in. Just saying.
I told you.
I believe you. Let's look at our last build, new build here. It is the one that works and seems strange to me. It is the witch.
Tell us why, Jeff. Why is it strange to you?
Here's why it seems strange to me. Because it seems to be built on a concept of you're getting your powers, or your magic or whatever, from some... other place, which in terms of story feels very warlocky, but it's a wizard build.
Yeah, you got a point.
The thing I found it strange is that they had to put in the witch aura, the fact that they are secretive and they are hunted down, they are burned in the stake. But they are magic users. How come the other wizards and the warlocks are not burned at the stake? So they had to create a fluff to say, no, the wizard's okay. You are going to burn at the stake because you made a pact with a pre-dawn war god. And that's not cool. So I think it's a little flimsy. It works, but you don't need... You can easily poke a lot of holes in it.
Well, I like the on the fluff side, they have the, you pick a coven, you're either the full moon coven or the dark moon coven, which is basically, are you a good witch or a bad witch? Kind of funny there. And on the mechanic side, a couple things I thought were interesting is, number one, all of their powers are wizard attack powers, and I didn't really see much in there that required any of the witch stuff. So I think the encounter powers might be, the encounter powers tend to be tied to your coven, but like the at-wills and the dailies... even actually a lot of the encounters above level one, any wizard could use them if they wanted to. And something that I thought was a little bit interesting is they tell you get three cantrips, but they only have one cantrip in the book. So you can't actually build your witch strictly from this one book. You actually would have to look up some other cantrip someplace else, although not having three cantrips isn't the end of the world, I suppose.
Yeah. And the I'll familiar does
something. Go ahead, Trace.
Familiar, that's kind of more of a wizard thing, too. Maybe that's why they went with wizard over warlock.
Could be.
Yeah.
And that's a good point about the familiar. The familiar is sort of the witch's spell book, right? And when you take an extended rest, you can use your familiar to switch out one of your spells for any other spell, not just any other one that's in your spell book. So if you could use, you know, four or five different level one dailies throughout the course of your career if you want to.
Which is actually a really interesting concept to me, because there was a second edition Al-Kadim class that worked similarly, only it was, you know, you used little elementals to run out to the elemental planes and bring back spells for you, which I feel like this does a nice job of sort of laying some groundwork that with some reskinning and reworking a few things could allow you to make that class that I'm now blanking on the name of.
And the fact that it's familiar, it has a mind, on its own. It's like it stays. It's subject to the witch only because it wants to. Like, as long as the power that that gives off power to the witch wants it, the familiar is there. But familiar is really a subject to this power. So it's a pretty neat way for the DM to convey like hooks and DM information to the players. Oh, my familiar came, it disappeared for a week, and when it came back, it brought me this information. This hook.
Yep. Okay. Moving on. Chapter, what are we on? 4. Character options. This is where we get character themes. We get, is this where we get what? Paragon Paths?
Epic Destiny.
Let me just ask
here.
One thing. One, all that stuff. Let me ask one thing from chapter 3 I forgot to ask.
All right. Go ahead.
They have.
How do you really feel, Jeff?
No, it's good.
Sorry,
it's good.
Pretty quick.
No, I'm having fun. We're good.
Is there's some fluff text right above the power. Is it something new?
No.
I haven't.
I don't think so. That's the flavor text above the power is like the introduction text before you get to the box. Mm-hmm. I think they've been doing that for a while, haven't they? That's a pretty
interesting
thing. It's often ignored.
I wish they would do it with monster powers, but...
You know what? You do have a point, actually. I'm flipping back through my Player's Handbook 1 right now, and no, the introduction text before the powers, they just had the flavor text before. They didn't have that little paragraph of description. So that is new. I think they did it in Heroes of Shadow, at least, but they did not do it.
I think they've done it back recently. I just don't know they've done it all along.
Yeah. Right, not all along.
Okay. Meanwhile, the chat room is calling me a witch. And...
Jeff is made of wood.
Yes, that's right. So let's go on to themes. Themes continue to be cool. Which themes here are cool? We have the
Tamer.
We have the Fey Beast Tamer. I'm not going to pronounce that right. The City Lord.
I actually looked that up. Its name is very good. It's the She Lord.
The She Lord. The Towthan and the Unseelie Agent. Themes go.
Okay, it's all about the Fae Beast Tamer. I really think that is the really cool one, and I feel like they've been trying for a while now to let people have a pet. Because I know when I first started playing 4th Edition D&D, my wife and I built our characters, and she's like, "I want a pet. You know, I don't care what else we got. I got to have a pet." And she was a Beastmaster Ranger. That's what she started with, and it feels like Fae Beast Tamer, the animal companion you get, pretty much does everything that the Beastmaster Ranger's companion did. I mean, you don't get the combined attack stuff, but aside from that, you know, hey, you have this animal, and it has a benefit, you know, an aura that comes along with it. It moves whenever you move. You don't have to take extra actions for it, but you can use a standard to make it attack. And it's pretty much every bit as good as the Beastmaster Ranger's companion, but anybody can take it for free on top of whatever they already have, which is, it's power creep, but it's pretty cool.
Uh-huh. Now, and actually, I like the one that's the She Lord, other than the fact that I can't pronounce it and the chat room likes to make fun of me for my inability to pronounce Gaelic tonight. But I like it because it is very story based, right? I mean, it's all about how I'm working for this larger power, and there's a lot of story built into this mechanical thing that is a theme.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's keep moving along. Let's go Paragon Paths. We largely have Paragon Paths that support the new class builds, right?
That's all we have. We have 4 Paragon Paths, 1 for each new build.
Okay.
And the prerequisite is you have to be that build.
Good enough.
There you go.
So if you're in that build, check them out. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Epic Destinies.
Epic Destinies are epic. Comparing to the very first Epic Destinies, that come out in the first Player's Handbook, those here are awesome. Man, the Witch Queen. Well, she's a Witch Queen. What else can you say? Now, level 21st, she reaches Witch Apotheosis. Wow, I loved it. I usually don't pay much attention to the Epic Destinies, but those ones are really over the top. I don't think I could create an adventure hard enough for those Epic Destinies. They are epic.
Yeah, I think my two favorite things about the Epic Destinies, number one was the Witch Queen's illustration. I think that picture on page 125 of the, you know, pretty nasty, you know, scary looking Witch Queen lady, but she's still beautiful. You know, I think that was the look on her face is excellent, I think, for a Witch Queen. And I also
She looks like a pirate.
and I think on page 122, the audience with the queen power from being Shiradi champion, I love the flavor of it. You basically remove yourself from battle for a while and get summoned to talk to, you know, the summer queen or whoever your patron is, and you just hang out there for a couple turns, and she gives you a benefit every turn, which is nice. You just have to remove yourself from battle and get patched up. But I love the thought of what is the rest of your party doing while you're having this audience with the queen in the middle of a fight. They're like, where did he go? This guy just disappears again, talks to his boss. Come on.
I also like that. I mean, a lot of the old Epic Destinies had a long sort of history of, I guess, maybe not a long history, but one of the things that my party always clung onto as we got into Epic Tier was there's a way to basically be immortal. You know, there's always these ways of you die and then you come back, or you don't really die, or you just die for the encounter and then you're not dead anymore, or whatever. These, I feel like. They codified that in a way that supports the story, but isn't just so much of a you just don't die anymore power, you know?
Yeah, like the witch, the her familiar just eats her up, and 24 hours later, just vomits her in a new body. It's a very witch, very witchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
And they continue to support the story, but at the same time, there's also it doesn't completely remove the risk. There are ways of getting through these powers that you can still kill a character. Anyway,
yeah.
Moving on. Feats. There's a bunch of feats.
Hey, I will say one thing I liked about the feats is that they did have feats for things like the gnome and the wild end. So people who say, you know, oh, there's no support for any of the older stuff from like Player's Handbook 2, Player's Handbook 3 anymore. I like that they gave a nod to some of that stuff, even if I don't particularly play gnomes or wild ends. They're here.
Yep. And lots of familiars. Very good. Very, very third edition.
I believe only one of the familiars is new. I think that there's like 11 familiars and 10 of them were already printed before or something like that, but I'm not positive on that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Even so, it's good that they are now on only a couple of pages altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Very nice. I also like that getting past feats, they've got a Feywild gear section that is not magic items. I continue to like the addition of more gear that's not magic items into the game.
I want the puppet.
I know, isn't the puppet awesome? I totally agree. Yes, I agree. The Pectic Music Box is nice. So many good things in here.
Yes.
Although the puppet reminds me of Order of the Stick, of the bard in Order of the Stick who used to run around with a little puppet, sock puppet on his hand.
Oh yeah, Elan and the banjo
yeah,
the clown.
Yeah.
if we have a fairy puppet in my game, it will be shaped like Banjo the Clown. Now, thank you, Jeff.
Excellent. Yeah, no problem. you also get a whole bunch of new magic items, of course, including. I like the gift things that they've sort of added in, whether it be in here they have fey gifts, but it was boons or divine gifts or whatever in previous editions.
Grandmaster training,
I really like those as sort of a story way of introducing something that's not just a magic item, right? It's something that's kind of special to that character that makes them unique.
Yeah, I think my favorite of all of those is the mount growth on 142, where you take like a mouse or a squirrel or something like that and turn it into the size of a horse so you can ride it. I mean, is it powerful? No. Is it cool? Oh, yeah.
Heck yeah.
I kind of don't like it. The something that I'm still getting used to, even 4 years later, that the magic items are on the players' books. It's like it's time to go shopping, boys. Let's crack open a book and buy make a wish list, make a Christmas list, and hand it over to the DM. I would like to have, well, actually, I do have more control of what the PCs get and don't get, but I wouldn't like them to, like, keep looking at magic items and wanting them, desiring them. Like,
yeah.
Why don't you give me a mount growth? I'll promise to be a good boy because in a PC book.
Right.
Then for you, it is a DM book then too. It's not just about the first chapter. It's also about the gear.
There you go.
Yeah. I guess right.
Very good. Sorry, the chat room is having all kinds of fun with the idea of
Grow Mount.
Pulling out some old school computer game references here, too. So the last chapter is really sort of, in many ways, I think the most unique chapter of this book, because it's a chapter that tries to do something that they haven't really tried to do before. It is the Build Your Story chapter, where they give you all these little tips and advice and mechanical bits to help you design and come up with story for a character.
Well, and I'd say it's more than that. I mean, this gives you the opportunity, if you want to sort of have a randomly generated backstory for your character.
Uh-huh.
You know, you could use dice for, and you can make choices if you want to, but a lot of it can be dice. You know, okay, where are you from originally? You roll a die, and okay, then your choices of races are these. Okay, you roll a die, and then you went to this place. You know, what did you do there? Did you join the city guard, or did you, you know, do some other thing for the queen there? Okay, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, that's and I imagine. We imagine we would play only like a fae campaign or a short story arc. So everybody sits together around the table with a book and randomly rolling, kind of like Traveler, but only for fae people. It's really fun, and I think if you do that together with your players, making them roll and coming up with the story all together with their stories together, it's lots of fun. Very unique chapter. I hope to see more of it on coming books.
Well, one thing I'd like to try sometime, I don't know if players would like it or not, but I think it'd be kind of cool to do it where the DM has the book and the players roll the dice, and the DM says, okay, here's the situation. You know, roll me a die. All right, here's your place where you're from. So you could be, and describe the place a little bit and say, all right, would you think you're more of an elf or more of a pixie or more of a human or what? And then say, okay, so what happens next? You roll a die, and then you ask the player to sort of fill in the blanks. You tell them a little bit about what's in the book, about this location that they're in and the job that they're trying, and then you ask the player, okay, you know, how would you do that? And then pick your ability score, roll it, and, oh, if you succeeded or failed, you ask the player to tell you what that's like, and the player's taking notes on all this as they go and building their backstory. I don't know if it'll work or not, but I'd love to try it sometime.
Totally.
Right on. And if nothing else, I'm not a big fan of randomly generating my background, because as a gamer, I'm a storyteller. That's what I do.
Sure.
So creating stories is fun, but ignoring that means I have several pages of just a list of inspiration.
Yeah.
You know,
good point.
Without ever rolling any dice, I can still flip through this and say, "Wow, this sounds cool. That's my background."
Oh, Jeff, you should play Mongoose's Traveler. It's tons of fun. Randomly generating your character.
Yeah, I played Traveler back in the day a little bit.
Well, I will say one other thing about Chapter 5. It's actually not in the chapter itself, but it's the appendix. The one-page appendix of the book has the character advancement table, which it's silly, but I like having this on one page. You know, I think that you have it back in the Player's Handbook 1, but in all the Essentials books that have come out, they have the advancement tables where they're spread through, like, here's the Heroic tier table and the Paragon tier table and the Epic tier table. It's nice at a glance, you know, just as a reference right there in the back of the book. Oh, yeah, how many feats do you get at this level and all that good stuff.
And there are legitimate times when I might be I've been at games, and the only reason I brought my Player's Handbook is for that table. So having it in having it in other books means I can store other things in that space.
And having it on the very last page of that book means it's always easy to find.
Right. Very good.
And
we made it to the end.
We forgot something very important. On page 151, we find out that Andronus, one of our characters that we are following through the book, gets transformed by a rabbit.
Oh, yes, I love that. He got turned into a bunny and she has to rescue him. I love that.
All right. I think we have finished this episode.
Woohoo!
And you know what?
Yay!
It is now time, before we say goodbye, that we need to mention our other sponsor of the episode. I got so into the discussion, I was going to stick it in the middle somewhere, and I didn't. But I need to. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Noble Knight Games, our longtime supporter and sponsor of the Vorpal Network. They are an online store, but they're also a brick and mortar store, so you don't have to feel bad about buying from them and hurting a friendly local game store. And they specialize in finding out of print material. My pick for this episode is Gale Force 9's D&D vinyl battle mats, licensed specifically for D&D settings. They have some that are Dark Sun specific, wilderness maps that would be perfect for the Feywild. And they only cost $16 each, being vinyl. They're easy to sort of just roll up and store. And that makes them durable little things that you can use over and over and over again. For $16, it seems like a very affordable way of doing sort of a more detailed battle map. So check it out at NobleKnightGames.com.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Cool, and we would like to thank our sponsors, Noble Knight Games and Greater Than Games, as well as Michael, the online DM, and Marcelo Dior.
Dior. Just like the...
Dior.
Yeah.
Online DM, where can people find you over on the internets?
You can find me on at onlinedm.wordpress.com or on Twitter as onlinedm1.
Very good. And Marcelo Dior, where can people find you?
Well, if you want to hear me ranting and in Portuguese, you could go to Terceira Terra or Terceira Terra with two R's .com. It's Third Earth in Portuguese. I actually have a couple of podcasts there where I talk about, role-playing games.
Very good. And I assume that people who speak Portuguese will be able to spell that, because I always have a heck of a time doing the show notes whenever you're on, trying to remember how to, trying to figure it out and get a link over there. And if people want to get a hold of us on the show, you can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. The biz line at 919-BIZTOME. That's 919-BIZTOME. And swing over to the forums at Gamers Haven Podcast, where people converse about the thing every now and then. The show and the stuff we do and what have you. Find show notes on thetomeshow.com. And before I let Tracy go on to the witty ending, it is time to figure out who is going to go home with the Heroes of the Feywild book. Does anybody have any suggestions on how I do it, or should I roll a die, and the first person who guesses the right number in the chat room wins it? Okay, we'll do it that way.
How many people do we have?
There are 13 people in the chat room right now.
Are they organized? Like, do you have a list of who's number one, number two, number three?
No.
Well, oh, okay. I was going to say, if they're in order, you can just, like, roll a number and see, you know, hey, I rolled a six. Number six person on the list. You're the one.
All right, but I can't do that. So I can roll, and then the first person who guesses the right number on the D20 can take it home. Okay, so everybody listen very...
Chaos.
Listen very...
Is it the Ravenloft D20?
It is the D20 from Castle Ravenloft. I'm going to roll it. You're going to listen very carefully, and you want to listen to what that number is going to be, and then give us your guesses. On your mark, get set, go. And now we're on a 15-second delay, so we'll see how long it takes them to start actually mentioning it in the chat room.
This is hilarious.
Oh, Tracy's wrong. Tracy's so wrong. Matt is wrong. Counting Q is wrong. Cato guessed the same thing. It's not 13. It's not 13. It's not 11. You'll never get it, people. It's not 19. No. This is great radio.
The imaginary number.
Tracy, are you trying to win? Cato gets it. It's 8. Cato gets it. It's 8.
Cato, no.
Cato Catonian. Who, again, I mentioned this at the top of the show, you have to be in the United States to win. I'm not shipping to other countries because that's expensive. Okay, stop guessing. Cato already got it.
15-second delay. What can you do?
And that, my friends, is episode 186. We've managed to get lost in the woods, find some help from a satyr, and Jeff, stop eating those toadstools and put some clothes on. I guess we should just wrap up this look at Heroes of the Feywild on...
The Tome. I'm on the wall.